From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. Facebook is paying a handsome $2 billion for Oculus VR, the maker of a virtual reality headset. Virtual reality has been hyped for decades. So far, it hasn't lived up to the hype. Facebook's Mark Zuckerberg sees that changing. Maybe one day you'll navigate a virtual room full of your Facebook friends' avatars. And maybe not. This hour on Point, Facebook makes a bet on virtual reality with Oculus. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. Do you see a headset in your Facebook future? Is this where we'll meet and greet virtual reality? How do you read Zuckerberg's play? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Well, okay, here's the story. Oculus is out of Irvine, California. 20 months ago, founded by Palmer Luckey, he's now 21 years old, homeschooled, got his start looking here at the Wall Street Journal repairing old Apple iPhones. Went to Kickstarter, raised more than $2.4 million in a Kickstarter campaign to help development of this product. Got a partner in with him from the cloud gaming world, and boom, they've got this headset, goggles you can put on. It's not unlike WhatsApp, which Facebook recently paid $19 billion for. Oculus is still not available to consumers, but it's out there selling its prototype to developers. One of them shared his set with his 90-year-old grandmother. It's like a headset, face mask, big set of goggles you put on, and you've got a huge field of vision, virtual reality you're looking at. Here's the 90-year-old grandma responding with the headset on.
It's so real, and it's a picture in here, huh?
Yeah.
Oh, Lottie.
That's pretty cool, right?
It sure is. And you know what? Is it my eyes or are the leaves blowing?
They're blowing. You're right. You see it.
Oh, man.
You think you're cooler than a 90-year-old grandma? Well, here last June at the Electronic Entertainment Expo annual trade fair, Wired magazine editor Peter Rubin experienced a new version of the Oculus Rift, as they're called, virtual reality headset.
Somehow, I'm actually really, really here. Really here. And like, I know that I'm talking to people who are in this room, but I've kind of mentally lost the topography of this room. Like, the room that I physically am sitting in right now, I kind of forget what it looks like.
And here's the user that matters, at least this week. Facebook CEO Mark Zuckerberg explaining why Facebook acquired Oculus in a conference call Tuesday. He called it a long-term bet on the future of computing and Oculus as the platform of this future. Here he, Zuckerberg, describes the Oculus headset.
When you put on our goggles, you enter a completely immersive computer-generated environment, like a game or a movie scene or a place far away. The incredible thing about the technology is that you feel like you're actually present in another place with other people. It's different from anything I've ever experienced in my life.
There's Mark Zuckerberg. He's putting down $2 billion. Joining me now from New York is Eric Limer, writer and editor and Oculus Rift user at the technology blog Gizmodo. Eric, thank you very much for being with us.
Hey, thanks for having me.
First, just the experience. You've put on this big set of goggles. What's it like in there?
It's incredible. So, I mean, what really brings home the experience is, I mean, the idea of having a big, giant screen in front of your face is something that's actually pretty easy to consider if you've ever sat, like, nose-to-nose with a TV. But what is great about the Oculus Rift is the way that the view sort of wraps around your eyes so that you're getting that... You're getting this real amazing feeling of immersion because there are things just off in the periphery, just like there would be in real life. And in addition to that, the headset is able to kind of track where your head is, how it's turning, and even the newer versions can track the way your upper torso is moving, which makes the world around you react as though you're inside of it. And the result of that is just absolutely incredible.
So it's not a fixed screen in front of you, or at least the perception is you turn your head and you're looking around, maybe 360.
Right. Yeah. No, you can definitely do that. In fact, there is a screen, but as far as the user is concerned, there is not
right.
a screen. Like you're not looking at an image projected onto something. It is just there all around you.
It's hardware. I guess it's software also. This was made for gaming. What's in there? What did you see in there? What's going on in that virtual world?
Well, a couple of the it depends. There's a lot of different small tech demos, but no really established games yet. So actually, probably the best example that I had is there's the beginnings of a game called Valkyrie, I believe, where you are a starfighter pilot, right? And so you're flying around in there, and then not only are you have a controller in your hands and you're controlling your fighter that way, like you would play a traditional game, but you can, the cockpit is all made out of glass, and you can look around above you, and the sensation as you, you know, do a turn or a loop and look around is so vivid and enthralling that, like, when I did it, I had a visceral reaction. You know, my stomach dropped because it's that convincing of a space around you. It's great.
Here's the now 21-year-old founder, 20 months ago of Oculus, Palmer Luckey. Oculus Rift, his virtual reality headset, his product. He's explaining it here to Jefferson Graham of USA Today's Talking Tech. This is a video blog put up last summer.
You take these goggles, you plug them into your computer that's running a game, and when you put them on, it's like you're looking around inside of the game. It's not just a screen floating out in front of you. You can actually turn 360 degrees, look in any direction, and have a full stereo 3D view of the entire game environment.
Okay, Eric Limer with Gizmodo. I'm a gamer. This is pretty cool. But here, and $2 billion these days, I mean, Facebook paid $19 billion for WhatsApp, so maybe this is chump change, but it's not nothing. What about a cool set of goggles with an immersive 360 experience is of interest to Mark Zuckerberg and Facebook?
Well, for this, I find it useful to kind of distinguish between the idea of Facebook as a social networking service and Facebook as the company that Mark Zuckerberg owns, right?
Why make that distinction? I mean, he said in his conference call that Oculus could become, quoting here, the most social platform ever. That sounds Facebook-y.
Well, yeah, and it is, but it's not necessarily Facebook, right? So Facebook is a huge social network that has the ability to bring people together, right? But the Oculus Rift is a play at something that's way further down the line than that. And so as far as Mark Zuckerberg is concerned, the Oculus Rift is less something that fits into Facebook, but is actually its own platform. And the distinctions between the two are kind of fluid. And so there are already great examples of the Oculus Rift being used in social ways that aren't necessarily social network-y, but just in, you know, the easy Facebook sort of analogy is you know, walking around in a virtual mall where all your Facebook friends are also avatars. But there are also examples. There's already a Oculus Rift demo which just consists of sitting in a theater with like one of your friends, which is a much more intimate but still sort of social connected way to hang out with people.
So we might say, do you want to watch a movie tonight? And we'd do it with our Oculus Rift on. We'd feel like we were watching it together, even if you were in New York and I was in L.A.
Right, exactly. And when you add the idea of Facebook to that, which is already sort of this universal medium for people to communicate, Facebook is just a great framework for different people who might be using the Oculus Rift to connect with each other in this very, virtual reality equivalent of a phone number, perhaps.
Zuckerberg in his statement says, we're going to make Oculus a platform for many other experiences. He said, imagine enjoying a courtside seat at a game, studying in a classroom of students and teachers all over the world, or consulting with a doctor face-to-face just by putting on goggles in your home. Okay, that in a way, that's like cool and uncool. I don't know, you're 20-something. Do you want to sit around with goggles at home interacting with people elsewhere? Is that appealing to you, Eric?
Yes, but I'm also like a huge geek. So it's
Geekus
not
Maximus.
Yeah. It's not appealing to me as a replacement for, you know, normal social interaction or actually going to do things. And I could see how, you know, for some people it could, you know, pose a problem of there's that, you know, horrible fear that the future is just everybody sitting in empty rooms with goggles on. But as a way to supplement your life by being able to give you first-person experiences that you never could have experienced otherwise. And, you know, like Zuckerberg said, there are entertainment applications for that, but also, you know, educational. Imagine you know, having goggles that you can put on students and all of a sudden they're on the International Space Station. Like, those are things that are very unique benefits that I think totally outweighs the kind of weird geekiness of sitting in a room with goggles on and, like, looking at the walls like there's something there.
We're going to talk about all this hour, but you're the one who's had it on. Give us more of the experience. You're inside the Oculus Rift, this sort of snorkel mask on your face. Tell us more about how it feels.
When you first put it on, it's a little bit weird, right? Because you do have this snorkel mask on your face. But once whatever you're doing boots up, that sort of just fades away. Mm-hmm. Especially in applications like the Valkyrie I mentioned. I think there's a new tech demo going around where you put the Oculus Rift down, you can look down at a simulated body, right?
Yeah.
And at that point, the experience is immersive enough that it's actually sort of disorienting when the body doesn't move the way yours does, because it seems like your body. I think probably one of the best ways to explain what it's like to use an Oculus Rift for the first time is, you know, there are the stories, which are maybe apocryphal, I'm not sure, about the first time that, you know, a moving picture was ever displayed. And there are people in a theater watching as a train is coming at them on a screen, and they want to scream and get out of the way because they know it's not real, but there's that visceral reaction because this is a new immersive form that they've never seen before.
Eric Leimer with Gizmodo, joining us from New York. He's been in there. Eric, thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
We're talking this hour about Facebook's virtual reality play with the $2 billion purchase of Oculus VR, VR as in virtual reality. Makers of the Oculus Rift virtual reality headset may be a new key to social media, or so says Facebook founder and CEO Mark Zuckerberg. Oculus, 20 months old, started with a Kickstarter campaign. Some of those who contributed to that are saying, you know, I chipped in on Kickstarter for Oculus and all I got was this lousy T-shirt. The now 21-year-old founder looking at a $2 billion deal for a company that doesn't have products out in the market yet. Lots of people thinking about where this may go. Yesterday on Bloomberg Television, Bloomberg West's editor-at-large Corey Johnson said this was a big purchase for a company that has no revenue and no product.
This is a big number for them to pay for a company that doesn't even have a product yet, let alone, you know, there's this ridiculous phrase that makes its way around Silicon Valley about companies being pre-revenue.
Which is
hilarious.
All right.
People actually seriously use this phrase. But this is a pre-product company. They have the developer kit they've sent around to some people. They've shown some demonstrations on.
Okay, skeptical. It's easy to be skeptical, but here's a little more at CNBC. Commentator Sheila Darmanian said this is riskier than other Facebook purchases.
Here's what I think is the difference about the Oculus deal. I mean, you can make a lot of arguments why WhatsApp and Instagram made sense for Facebook. This was a bet. Mark Zuckerberg even described it as a bet in his release. Everyone says this is a bet on virtual reality. There's a lot of tech bets that don't pan out. Remember 3D? Everyone thought that was going to be the future. I still have those 3D glasses collecting dust next to my TV.
Okay, more skepticism. In February, Mark Zuckerberg hopped over to Stanford University's Virtual Human Interaction Lab to talk with its director, Jeremy Bailenson, for hours about virtual reality and social media applications. Wouldn't it be interesting to know what they talked about? Well, let's ask. Jeremy Bailenson joins us now from Stanford, California. He's author of Infinite Reality, Avatars, Eternal Life, New Worlds, and the Dawn of the Virtual Revolution. And apparently Mark Zuckerberg's go-to guy, or one of them in this realm. Jeremy Bailenson, thank you very much for being with us.
Hey, Tom, how are you?
I'm great. What was on Zuckerberg's mind when he came over to talk VR?
So I run a virtual reality lab at Stanford, and what we do is we build immersive simulations that are a little bit ahead of the curve. So we heard a wonderful description of Oculus from Eric. What I do is I run a lab that is trying to push forward the best VR that can be. So in my lab, in addition to moving your head around, you can actually walk around a space, and it's an extremely compelling simulation where one of our go-to demos is that you look over the edge of this pit, and one out of three adults literally can't take a step forward onto a plank over this pit. So what we do is we run a lab that build extremely real, high-fidelity virtual reality, and we test to see the psychological reaction people have. We build applications to see how virtual reality works. And because we are the most advanced virtual reality lab in the world, we get a lot of high-profile visitors, and Mr. Zuckerberg was one of them in February.
So maybe you're dancing from my question here. I want to talk a lot about that technology and how you see it evolving, but what was he interested when he came? He just laid down $2 billion this week for this little company. You must have had a sense of what was on his mind from those hours you spent chatting.
He came to experience VR, and he asked a lot of questions. Tom, to be honest, we spent a lot of time talking about not how he could use VR for Facebook, but how in general we can use virtual reality to help the world. So a lot of my lab's research looks at how we can build applications to help the environment, to how do we can improve education, how we can increase altruism. And what I did is I took him through lots of these simulations, and I told him about our lab's research findings. And then we really just spent a lot of time thinking about, in a world where a billion-plus people get virtual reality, what can we do to make the world a better place? How can we change the nature of what it feels like to help somebody? Can we really connect people with their environmental consequences by putting them in very intense simulations of what global warming might be like? We really thought long and hard about how to use the technology to help the world, and really spent less time talking about how virtual reality could help Facebook in the short term. And Tom, to be honest,
yeah,
he was a great listener, and I did a lot of the talking. I guess that's what...
Okay, that's interesting. I mean, in a world where... So take us along that horizon. What did he hear from you? Describe some of the applications or the sort of vision of that future that you shared with Mark Zuckerberg.
So a lot of the lab's research right now focuses on the environment. I think this is a critical problem, that it's hard to connect human activity with a bleak environmental future that may be 20 years away. So a lot of our research looks to put people in very visceral connections where you feel like you're in an environment, and to highlight your connection, the consequences of your action. So here's an example. Imagine you use that really fluffy, soft toilet paper, which most people tend to use. It turns out a lot of the pulp from that toilet paper is taken from second growth forests, some even from virgin trees. Why are we using cutting down trees just for a purpose of using toilet paper? A nice op-ed was written in 2009 for the New York Times, but it still doesn't change behavior. It's hard to find non-recycled toilet paper. We brought subjects to the lab, put them in this amazing, beautiful forest where they looked around, and they could walk around this forest. They then used what's called a haptic device, which actually moves your arms for you, and they used a chainsaw to really feel what it's like to cut down a tree as a consequence of they used a non-recycled toilet paper.
Okay, so sympathy for the tree, for the forest, the consequences of that. What other kinds of applications?
So for that one, what we did is we tracked their paper use later on in the physical world, and they use 20% less paper than any control condition that we tried. Other applications, let's think about health. So imagine that we talked about seeing other avatars. What about seeing an avatar of yourself? And in our studies in the lab, we've demonstrated that if you see yourself in a virtual mirror, and as you're exercising physically, your virtual self loses weight in an accelerated manner. This gives you something called self-efficacy, the belief that you can change your exercise behavior. And we've demonstrated that this, as a health application, works quite well. Another example that we work on is education. So the kind of obvious example with education is, well, let's put somebody on the moon or let's put someone in the forest. And I love that. But I want to think more about people, because Zuckerberg obviously cares about social. And a lot of the work in my lab has demonstrated that let's not think about the content, but let's think about the teacher and the co-learner. So imagine for a second you're an African-American girl learning computer science in middle school, and you walk into a classroom, and all your co-learners are 19 white men, and white boys, and the teacher is a white man. And there's a lot of great research that shows that this stereotype threat really changes the way that minorities have to learn. It impacts them, and they do worse in these classes. What my lab's work has done is, well, in VR, there's no rules. So you can change the co-learners. You can make it so a woman walks into a computer science class and half the class is female. Moreover, there's no reason why, because the teacher might have been a white male in the physical world, why can't we change the teacher's gender, the teacher's race? And by breaking these social physics rules, we've demonstrated all sorts of beneficial learning and social effects.
How persuasive is it going to be, or is it already, Jeremy? I mean, am I going to be in there thinking like I'm in a classroom, or I'm in there thinking I'm in a simulated room full of cartoon characters?
So for 20 years, I've literally been building virtual reality simulations, putting people in and studying what's called presence, which is, do people feel these characters are real? And Tom, I can tell you unequivocally that when an avatar looks you in the eye or steps towards your personal space, that we've measured your physiology, there's people that have measured your brain, we measure your behavior, people treat avatars the same way they treat real people. There's literally dozens and dozens and dozens of experiments that show this.
I got a million questions. So do our listeners. We're going to hear from James McQuivy from Forrester in just a moment. He's skeptical, I think. But Leanne, Murfreesboro, Tennessee. Leanne, what do you think? You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I think this is exactly where things are headed. I think it is a leveling agent culturally. I think if you could attend a service at a mosque without actually going into a mosque, think how much you could learn. I think this just holds immense potential.
And are you willing to do it, like go to the Den and put on goggles and spend an hour or two, you know, sitting on the couch and feeling like you're somewhere else? That's appealing to you?
Yes, I think it is. And I think it's appealing to my teenage son as well.
Yes. So you get why Zuckerberg may have grabbed for this thing.
I think it was a brilliant investment, yes.
We'll see. Leanne, we hear that readiness to experience things you might not otherwise. Quincy in La Crosse, Wisconsin. Quincy, you're on.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
So the thing I want to say is that I'm a huge gamer, and I was so super excited about this because, you know, VR has been a thing that we've been talking about since I was, you know, like 5 years old.
Wait, you were excited about Oculus Rift, the Googles, or excited about the Facebook purchase?
The Oculus Rift. I am terrified by the purchase. I think that this destroys everything that we were promised. Because when it was first announced, it was a monitor. It wasn't a platform. It wasn't a new console. It was something that you could use with existing technology or make your own games or your own technology to go with it.
What's wrong with Facebook owning it for you, Quincy? What's the problem?
It's locked up in this tiny little Facebook box, and it's only going to do what Facebook says is okay. You're not going to see people making mods so that it works on games that it wasn't allowed to work on before. You're not going to see people making mods for games that aren't published by AAA publishers to add the Oculus Rift functionality.
Yeah.
No, you're going to see EA games get it. You're going to see, you know, the other big name, you know, companies get the Oculus Rift support, and everyone else is going to be left by the wayside, and there isn't going to be anything we can do because the keys to the kingdom are locked inside of Facebook.
Quincy, we've got it. There's a stone cold gamer who sees his hot rod being taken away. That's a fair fear, isn't it, Jeremy? I mean, Zuckerberg's going to have his own applications here, not for everybody.
So first let me comment on the first caller's idea about preserving culture, because I think this is a home run. And
yeah.
In my lab, we've got a demo of you get to go visit Michelangelo's David. And it's for even artists who come and see this are just blown away by it. Why should I have to fly all the way to Italy to see a single statue? And why can't people who can't afford to fly to Italy get to see the statue all the time? So this idea of preserving culture is an important one. You know, for the second caller, how this is going to affect the vision of gaming that was promised by Oculus is something that's going to have to be navigated. I have a fairly strong suspicion that the reason Zuckerberg bought this, and this is not based on anything he said, this is just my opinion, you know, he liked Oculus, and I can't imagine he would go away from the vision that they had, but, you know, we'll see where he decides to take it. Again, my hope, and this is saying this as a citizen, is that, you know, Zuckerberg was the number one philanthropist last year. He gave almost $1 billion to charity. My hope is that he wants to take this technology and use it to help the world, to improve education, to improve healthcare, to make people more connected in ways that help the world.
Hmm. We shall see. Ryan in Atlanta, Georgia. Ryan, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Hi, Tom.
Hey.
Thank you for having me.
Sure.
Hey, so just to share my thoughts, I believe that virtual reality, from what everyone has shared, is absolutely fascinating, but I believe Facebook's purchase of it absolutely destroys any of the potential it may have had. And I'm actually quite worried to see that yet another brilliant startup is being consumed by a huge corporation yet again. And I think it's rather sobering, unfortunately. There's a lot of potential that I think is being lost with Facebook's specific purchase.
Why shouldn't it be liberating? Facebook's got a billion-plus users. They can do cool stuff with this, have all the resources to do it, and propagate it out to the world, get it into social networking and media. Why not, Ryan?
Well, I'm reminded of Google's purchase of YouTube many years back and how people thought that that would support YouTube and make it even bigger. And now today, it's just become a platform where arguably, it's been filled with advertisements, and you have all these notions of the loss of sort of the input of the user, and it's being absorbed into this framework where now you have to wait for a 30-minute, for a 30-second advertisement. I believe that Facebook, as grand as it might have an idea with Zuckerberg, I believe they'll just use it as a platform to put in the occasional advertisement. Imagine that, being in virtual reality, and you'll see an advertisement for Candyville or Farmville or something.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
So I see it as, unfortunately, neutering any possibility of just the free expression of what Oculus Rift would have. And they'll just use the corporate side to try and generate a quick profit and use it to reach out to that billion-person user base with new products and advertisements.
Well, that's a lot of goggles sold there, a lot of Rifts sold to throw all in there. But who knows? Maybe what you'll see is not the Michelangelo, but have a Coke and a smile. You may be right. Ryan in Atlanta, I appreciate your call. Jeremy Bailenson, please stand by at Stanford. James McQuivey joins us right now from Chicago, Vice President and Principal Analyst at Forrester Research, focused on consumer technology. James McQuivey, thank you very much for being with us. Do you see what Mark Zuckerberg's up to here? Does it look like a winner for Facebook?
You know, there are really three questions that we need to consider here, Tom. And it's, is virtual reality going to be a big deal, as Jeremy suggests? And I firmly believe it will. But the second and third questions are the problems here. The second question is, are we going to do it often? Are we going to frequently engage in virtual reality behaviors? And because that leads to the third question, which is, should Facebook spend $2 billion on it? If we're not going to use it frequently, and I maintain that we aren't, most of the really awesome examples that Jeremy shared are things that people will do very infrequently, even though they're super, and I want them all to happen, but they'll do them very infrequently. And the things that people will do frequently with virtual reality are gaming applications, which are not actually a very good fit for Facebook's business model. So it leads to the third question, is should Facebook have spent $2 billion on this particular company? And the answer is no. And it suggests that Facebook looked at this and said, hey, there's a great partner. We should call them and do something really interesting with them because that's who we are and that's who they are. And when they got on the phone, I'm betting that the people at Oculus said, you know, actually, we can't talk to you because we're in potential buy negotiations with somebody else, at which point Facebook immediately said, uh-oh, we better buy them before someone else
does. Get out the checkbook and snap them up so that they've got their Google Glass version or whatever.
Really the only thing that explains why the price point and why the early move before, as you said in the earlier break, they even have a product.
How are you so sure it won't be frequent use? I mean, why wouldn't it be as frequent as, I don't know, browsing Twitter or reading a magazine or reading a book or watching TV? Those are pretty common things.
Watching TV is. The other things you mentioned, actually, some of them are getting less and less common by the day. But think about it this way. All the things that Jeremy's describing, we can do some form of today. And when we first got the Internet, all the art that was placed on the Internet was phenomenal. I spent hours going through places in India that I would never see personally and still haven't seen personally all these years later. We can do these things today, yet we choose not to. Instead, we follow celebrities on Twitter. It's not that the technology failed us. It's that that's just not what we as a culture want to do frequently.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about Facebook's virtual reality play with the $2 billion purchase of Oculus VR, makers of the Oculus Rift virtual reality headset, maybe a new key to social media, or thus spake Mark Zuckerberg, sort of. We're joined by James McQuivey. He's vice president at Forrester Research. All over this, Jeremy Bailenson, who sat down with Mark Zuckerberg in February to talk VR, virtual reality potential. He's at Stanford University's Virtual Human Interaction Lab, founding director there. In a minute, we'll talk about Candy Crush and its company King Digital going public yesterday. That did not work out so well. James Surowiecki will join us. Jeremy Bailenson, James McQuibby, lots of response online here. I mean, lots. Shizmac says, I think people should get more involved with actual reality. Neil thinks about this and has a one-word sort of a predictor of the future for this: porn. Dustin says, a further deadening of my innate humanity by market-oriented technological advancements. Here, Scott says, reality is highly overrated. Sounds like he's ready to get in there. And Bill says, this is what I want. Says, I'll pass on Google Glass. Aileen is calling from Biddeford, Maine. Hi, Aileen. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
Okay.
I just wanted to share an experience. I was born in Brazil, but I live in the United States.
Yeah.
And a couple of months ago, when my grandmother passed away, we were not able to make it to her funeral. But with the help of our friends and family in our country, we were able to watch her whole funeral, the church service, all the way to the, you know, to the cemetery through FaceTime.
So you were in Maine, but watching your grandmother's funeral in Brazil through FaceTime.
Through FaceTime, and wow. We watched the whole church service the whole, you know, all the way, the whole thing. And that really helped, you know, to heal and to get closure. And it was a really good experience, especially for my dad, because he was able, you know, we all sat together in our living room.
Wow.
And we cried, you know, with our family members. And it was great. So
when you hear about virtual reality, can you imagine doing that with goggles on and really feeling like you're there?
Yes, I think that would be amazing in the future, because technology like this will be able to bring people together. Because when you talk about, you know, actual reality, and people should, actually be, you know, go out and talk to people. You know, that's not always possible when your loved ones live so far away. So I think technology like this will be so wonderful in the future, just bringing people together. I think it's amazing.
Aileen, you're pretty great. You make it very vivid. I'm going to take your case to James McQuibby. James, maybe this is the counter to your skepticism. I mean, there's the real world and real family, and this is social. Ultimate social, in a way, observing a funeral, and it meant something.
Proving my point. She's actually proving my point. That was a wonderful and beautiful example of how infrequent this kind of need is going to be, and how we can already do it today with tablets in our laps instead of needing these extra devices. So virtual reality is going to be great. It's just going to be infrequent.
But infrequent. I mean, there's a funeral, but there's birthdays, and there's baby showers, and there's high school performances.
Members. Yeah. Yeah. Facebook gets its youngest members to touch it 100 times a day. So when we're talking frequency of Facebook use, we're talking about something that you're going to do not just once a day, but multiple times a day. And if you do virtual reality 2 or 3 times a week, that's a success from the perspective of Oculus, but not from Facebook. And that's my whole point.
Yeah.
It's just not good for Facebook, even if it's good for humanity.
We'll see. I want to take that to Jeremy Bailenson, but let me get one more call. Mike here, Madison, Wisconsin. Mike, you're on the air. What do you think?
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
In my virtual reality, I can see Shakespeare shuddering. From a brain physiology perspective, this might become unlimited heroin in solitary confinement.
Unlimited heroin in solitary confinement. What do you mean?
Basically, the tendency to keep the goggles on is going to be so strong, it's going to be addictive, far more addictive than we have ever realized. And from a brain perspective, that brain is going to keep continuing going back and saying, I want this, I want this, I want this drug, and people who will be virtually in solitary confinement, because they'll lose their social skills, they'll lose all the other brain functions that we need to be human beings. So,
Mike, are you just speculating? Are you just speculating here, or do you have some reason to scientifically to think this might be true? I mean, who are you to say that?
From a behavioral scientist standpoint,
okay.
I've been studying addictions, and the way addictions work is it pleasurizes the part of the brain that basically can't stop it, you can't control it. And I see the same addictions with texting.
Wow.
That to me will be very, very small compared to this addiction.
Boy, that's interesting. Behavioral scientist Mike, point taken from Madison. Jeremy, I mean, here's the range. James McQuibby says, hey, once in a while, but not nearly enough. And on the other hand, there's Mike saying, we're going to be so addicted to this, we won't take the goggles off, Jeremy.
Look, I agree with both James and Mike. These are really important points.
I run the VR lab at Stanford, and I don't advocate everybody use VR all the time. That would be a horrible world.
But we might anyway. You know, you don't advocate that we use heroin all the time, and people do.
The metaphor I like to make is VR is like uranium. It can heat homes and it can destroy nations. What VR gives you is an intense and powerful experience that you couldn't possibly have in the physical world. And as we move forward, we need to think about how do we regulate that? How do we moderate that? Look, the internet is an addictive force. That's without Facebook feeling like you're at a party. What's going to happen when Facebook feels like you are around your friends or at that social event and you can't tell they're not right there? I think that's a wonderful world when you get to go visit your family that you couldn't visit otherwise. How we prevent people from preferring that to face-to-face interaction is the challenge that we have to think about as we move forward. My lab's work shows that VR characters, avatars, feel real. How do we keep this innate preference towards actual people and keep it separate is a challenge that we have to keep working on.
But talk about a new challenge. One more call here. Aaron in Nashville, Tennessee. Aaron, you're on.
Yeah, I think that we need to pay attention to the guy who wrote in one word, and that's porn. I mean, what's the biggest business on the internet? That is pornography. And all these things are great, but, I mean, pornography is a very real problem, and I think that the Oculus is probably going to that's where people are going to be trapped. They're going to be trapped in pornography more than anything else.
Talk about a potential double addiction there, the goggles and the porn, hypothetically. Well, not so hypothetical and a lot of the internet use. James McQuivey, is this Mark Zuckerberg's response to Google Glass? Is this these guys are all loaded with cash now, up to the gills. Are they all just terrified the other one will take off on a new platform? They've got to have their thing for your eyes. They've got glass. He's got
that's exactly it. They're so afraid that they're going to miss the next big thing, whether it's a sensor in your home, a lock on your door, a device attached to your wrist or to your face, that they're all just climbing over each other to get in there. I'm not sure that Oculus is the best response to Google Glass or that it's even the next thing that you should pay attention to. Of course, it is something that will be successful eventually, just as I said, not in high frequency except for those addicts, which I think is an appropriate point that others have brought up.
I'm really wondering about your sense of infrequency. You may be right, but human behavior does change over time. I'm sure not that long ago, people would have been stunned by the amount of time that people are looking down at a little smartphone in their hand these days.
Yeah, the big difference is, though, you can do that and do something else at the same time. Most virtual reality implementations require whole presence. You have to be completely focused. You can't actually see the rest of your world around you. You can't interact with other people. Even the crazy amount of TV that we spend watching, 4.5 hours a day typically, you're usually doing something else while you watch TV. And that's the thing. Virtual reality commands your attention, and it's just not attention that we have to give to it very, very often. And so that'll make it a premium, wonderful experience that we do occasionally.
James McQuivey, Vice President at Forrester Research, joining us from Chicago. James, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you so much.
Jeremy Balinson at Stanford, one last image from you. What's it going to be? We'll be sitting around the virtual campfire singing folk songs, but actually we'll all be home, you know, in the bedroom with goggles on?
You'll be sitting around the campfire with a goggle. Next to you will be your great-great-great-grandfather that you've never met. You'll hit a button and 30 of your friends will join. Some of them will be there in real time. Some of them will be recording from 2 hours ago. Whatever you want to be there will be there.
Hey, and look, there goes Mark Zuckerberg with $2 billion less in his pocket, virtually, or really, I guess. Jeremy Balinson, it's a fascinating prospect. I don't know where it's going to go, but it's supercharged right now. You're great to be with us today. Founding director there of Stanford University's Virtual Human Interaction Lab, author of Infinite Reality, Avatars, Eternal Life, New Worlds, and the Dawn of the Virtual Revolution. Jeremy Balinson in California, thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks, Tom. This is great.
In a moment, we check in on yesterday's initial public offering of King Digital Entertainment, the maker of the very popular online game Candy Crush. This is On Point.
You
You may know that music from Candy Crush. King Digital Entertainment, the maker of the online game Candy Crush, had a terrible debut on the stock market yesterday, its shares sinking more than 15% from its opening price. The company has more than 180 games, but earns three-quarters of its revenue from Candy Crush. Wall Street apparently was not confident that was enough. Joining me now from New York is one of King Digital's skeptics, James Surowiecki, staff writer for The New Yorker, who wrote the essay titled One Hit Wonders for the March 17th issue of the magazine. James Surowiecki, it's been a long time. Welcome back to On Point.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me on.
What was the play here? Is this the Krispy Kreme donut offering of the digital game world? You know, they make one great donut. Krispy Kreme went public. Why not Candy Crush?
Well, I mean, in some ways, I think actually Krispy Kreme is probably in better shape. I mean, just because donuts, you can sort of assume people are always going to want to eat donuts. I mean, and Krispy Kreme has, even though it went through a sort of fallow period there after it went public, I think is kind of rebounded in recent years. The challenge for King is that Candy Crush, while enormously addictive and a tremendous game, and they have actually figured out ways to make huge amounts of money from it right now, you know, the problem really is that it's a fad. I mean, it's a popular fad, and I suspect it's one that'll be around for a while. But the real challenge for any maker of products like these is, can you make the next one, and can you make the one after that? And that's really where I think investors are, you know, to my mind, justifiably skeptical about the pretty hefty valuation that King was given when it went public.
We want to get your high analysis, but just give us a low description first of Candy Crush Saga, the game. For listeners who have not played it, where do people play it? What's it like? What's the game? What's the addictive quality?
So it's a mobile game, so it's basically designed for phones and tablets for the most part. You can also play it on your PC or your Mac, but it's mainly played on phones and tablets. It's a great game to play sort of in like interstitial periods when you're just waiting around. What you're basically trying to do is get three or four or occasionally five in a row of these candies. It's a game that's somewhat similar to, say, Tetris. That's not quite right, but it sort of visually looks like it. Mm-hmm. And you essentially are trying to clear the screen. In some cases, you're clearing jelly. In other cases, you're trying to bring ingredients down. But basically, the idea is you're trying to essentially kind of clear this board by matching three or four or occasionally five of these candies. And the two keys to the game are one, it's easy to learn but difficult to master, which is obviously a very good thing for a game. And King has done a very good job of kind of, you know, I don't know how many there are now, something like 400 or 500 screens. So the further along you get, the harder it gets. And the trick from a financial point of view is that if you get to a point where you can't go on, you can buy more lives, or you can buy these kind of special tools to help you clear the screen.
Right.
Or the other thing you can do, which King, is you can bother your Facebook friends and ask them to help you by lending, essentially giving you lives.
That they have purchased.
It's annoying, but it's a way of maximizing the viral quality of the game.
So people are so into these pixels going across the screen or not going across the screen that they're willing to pay money to move it along, to make it work for them.
And it's pretty huge amount of money. I mean, King last year made almost $2 billion in sales, and its profits were almost $600 million. So that's a very impressive performance. We should not downplay that. But the real problem is you know, going forward, how sustainable is that money? And that, I think, is a real question.
How much might an individual player spend in a year if they were an avid player to sort of, you know, enhance their Candy Crush capability?
Yeah, it's a great question. I mean, King actually says that a pretty small percentage of their people actually end up paying money, of their players end up paying money, something like 5%, maybe 10%. And I've played it, and I have paid some, but I think if you do the math, I mean, in some cases, it's probably upwards of, you know, $70, $80, which on the one hand is actually about what you'd pay for a normal video game, say on a console. But on the other hand, given that it's, you know, a free game, it's quite amazing that they're being able to turn it into so much cash.
I mean, they're not the first company that stumbled in their IPO, but yet there are companies that come back from that, Facebook not least.
Yes, absolutely. I think the big difference, obviously, is that Facebook, you know, that was just a situation where they, you know, they did the deal badly. There was some information that Facebook hadn't released. And the core value proposition, to use business jargon, of Facebook wasn't really in question. I mean, you know, they had 600 million users and whatever. People figured they were going to be able to figure out how to monetize them eventually. The real challenge for King is not to end up like Zynga, which is really the most sort of similar predecessor. So Zynga, which made Farmville, another very popular game, another game that was really connected to Facebook, was very successful, went public, and once Farmville stopped being as popular as it was, you know, Zynga didn't really have anything to take its place. So Zynga stock is now down, I think, more than 50% from where it went public.
JP Morgan, Credit Suisse, Bank of America, Merrill Lynch, all leading the book running managers here for this stock offering. Who loses when it goes down 15%? I mean, there's still a lot of money in through the door for King Digital.
Yeah, I mean, so King itself raised more than $300 million. It has that money now in the bank, and its executives took home, you know, more than $150 million. So they have a lot of money in cash, and they're also now worth a huge amount on paper. You know, the big losers were really the people that bought at the basically bought the IPO at the open, because it opened down, I think, almost 2 points, or maybe a point and a half, and then just kept falling. So I think the other loser in this, though, and this is what the essay I wrote a few weeks ago was really about, is the problem for King now is, you know, they had a great gig going. They were making tons of money, et cetera. Now they have to worry about public shareholders, and, you know, it's just going to be this constant drumbeat about how their stock price is not keeping up. And I don't know, to me, it just seems like an enormous amount of hassle. But I guess if you can walk away with $150 million in your pocket, it's probably worth the hassle, I suppose.
And a valuation of some billions, maybe not quite the billions they dreamed of. James Sirwicki with The New Yorker. It's always great to talk with you, James. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Sure. Thanks for having me on, Tom. I appreciate it.
And there we have Candy Crush, the story of the not quite so successful IPO of King Digital Entertainment. Listeners, thanks for joining us today. Always great to have you here. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.